I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And later on, we're going to get our wands out as we talk about Harry Potter being re-released in iBooks form. Now, before you put down your spellbook and think this is a travesty of technology podcasting, because what has Harry got to do with tech? Everything's wizardry and magic. Don't worry, there's a great angle, and we've got a great guest to talk about it with us. But first, the UK police force has seen a spike in drone incidents, according to The Guardian. The Guardian? Possible Freudian slip there on the old conversation banana. The Guardian had filed a Freedom of Information request, and it had found that there has been a significant increase in the number of cases where members of the public have reported nuisance drone flying to the local police force. So let's have a look at some of these numbers that Guardian got hold of. Thames Valley Police recorded 21 incidents in 2014 to one. That rose to 80 this year so far. And the Metropolitan Police logged 21 cases this year, up from only one the previous year. So that's roughly, well, I was going to say actually it's roughly quite a big rise that was similar between the two, but it isn't. One's 21 times greater than last year. So we'll just skip over that. Anyway, the concerns have flagged eyebrows, if that is such a thing, with Scotland Yard, who says that in the last 24 months, concerns have ranged from drones over massive crowds at Christmas events and devices being used to ferry drugs into prisons or to commit sexual offences. I don't want to get too crude about this, because the mental image in my head did initially have a drone with a pair of miniature hands on. But of course, that's not the case. This is almost certainly because of the cameras fixed to most of these drones. So number one, I mean, I'm not surprised by this, because sales of drones have gone up through the roof. So the fact that there are, you know, naughty people playing with these in undesirable ways, possibly not that surprising. Would you agree with that, Ian?
I would say that's the least surprising thing ever said in a conversation.
Well, this is good news then. Consider the following tangent, a bonus. There are three British companies who have banded together to do something. These companies are Enterprise Control Systems, Blighter Surveillance Systems, and Chess Dynamics. Now, these are companies that produce things along the lines of RF radio jammers. So they're the kind of things that block radio signals and nuisance phone calls, I guess, things like that. CCTV cameras, radar systems for scanning traffic, all that sort of stuff. And what they've done is they've come together to produce something that, according to the BBC, is called an anti-UAV defense system. And this is the really interesting thing, because we're seeing this quite large British uprising, not only in the interest in drones, but also in British companies banding together to try and produce new ways to fight them. And so there's a BBC report that came out this week to say that these companies have come up with a device that essentially jams the drone signal in the sky and will effectively force it to, for want of a better word, plummet to the earth. Essentially, it's jamming the signal between the operator's handheld, well, it's not always handheld, but it's the operator, if you like, and the technology he's using or she's using to control the UAV and the UAV itself. It basically can't get any signal and will, if it hasn't got an automated mode, fall or come to a standstill, and then the operator will go and have to fetch it like some sort of large dead plastic bird.
I think they mostly do have an automated mode. I think the thing that makes drones easy to fly is the fact that they are sort of basically self-righting and self-hovering and all that kind of stuff. So I think probably what will happen here is that they'll just hover in their, you know, I'm lost mode, and then eventually descend. Which is a good way of doing it, actually.
It is, and some of them do know, because they have GPS, they do know where they were launched from.
Yeah,
idea being they can go back, which is fine if your operator hasn't moved. If you're doing it on a boat, not necessarily ideal.
Well, you shouldn't do the DJI, who do all the clever, you know, their drones are very clever and very advanced, and you know, you shouldn't move at all. It's just a terrible idea, because this thing's worth like a grand, and you want it back essentially.
Well, so my brother Andy, who's been on the show before a few times, has had a couple of these, and one of them the other day, I can't remember now if it broke in the air or if the battery, the battery may have died, and it plummeted 200 feet from the air and shattered on the ground. Now, that wasn't ideal, I think, by anybody's standards.
No.
But it does cause concern that these things are capable of going wrong and plummeting. And so I'm always concerned that as companies start coming up with new ways to tackle what looks like a new business opportunity, you know, who's regulating this? And that's the final point I wanted to come to on this topic. And unfortunately, this was actually mentioned in the BBC piece as well, which is that the UK Civil Aviation Authority actually isn't investigating using any of these technologies soon. The Beeb's quoting somebody, a spokesperson from the UK CAA, who says, it's not something that we really feel the need to be doing. Our focus is on educating consumers.
Yeah, they don't really do that. It's not their bag. Like, I think this is more down to private industries to say, we don't want drones over our land, and then to pay to set up something along this line. And that's pretty reasonable. And
it's
quite a good solution, because DJI obviously have their GPS blackout, so you can't, in theory, take a DJI drone into Heathrow airspace, say. And with these alongside it, that's kind of a good idea, a good way of stopping people from flying where they shouldn't.
There's an interesting thing I saw on a podcast the other day about a gentleman who flies a bunch of drones near the new Apple campus in Cupertino in California.
I've seen that footage. It's amazing.
Well, the footage is very interesting, but there's a story behind it, which is that there is a law that Apple owns something around 100 feet of the space above the campus, within which it's not permitted for anyone to fly drones. So what the chap has to do is just make sure that he only goes into the space they're building above the threshold that Apple has got the legal right to enforce. And then he can prove, well, actually, I was at, you know, your restriction is something like 83 feet, I think. So, well, I was at 85 feet, so technically not a problem. But it's just another interesting thing. I mean, as a side note, the US Federal Aviation Authority, I did see a note saying that they are signing agreements to test technology that detects drones and then reports where the drone is. Whereas here, it seems that our aviation regulator is focusing more on just trying to get people to understand the dangers and the safeguards that are in place to allow for drone flight to be possible. I mean, the last time we took one out recently in West London, I just called the police first.
Oh, right. Okay, good idea.
We were in a park, and I just called, no, not 999,
yeah,
just
obviously
the local force, and just said, we've got a drone, we're in this particular part of Ealing. A, is that all right? And B, just wanted to let you know. And they said, it's fine, just don't fly near windows, and if it's got a camera, don't fly it in front of people or children. I thought, well, that's a perfectly reasonable explanation and perfectly reasonable. And then they knew if anybody called. They said, don't worry. Is it on the common? Yes, that's fine. It's just someone who's testing a camera or what have you.
It's interesting. I mean, part of me understands the need to be careful about such things. But at the same time, I don't want to just stop drones from flying. I don't think that feels like a really restrictive thing that shouldn't happen. But I do take the point that there is a danger, particularly batteries running out and things like that. So it's a really difficult one, this. I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, because I've got a drone that that actually doesn't work at the moment, but I would like to get it fixed. And I think it's becoming more and more difficult to fly it. But whenever I've had a drone out, people have been far more interested in it than they have annoyed by its presence. You know, they find them fascinating.
Intrigue and annoyance are one side of the fence, but the one that I really fear is paranoia, because the last thing I want is somebody coming out with a shotgun and thinking I'm a terrorist.
Well,
because that's one of the complaints that does happen. That, in fact, there was someone who reported a crime because a man saw a drone near his garden and shot it with his rifle.
Well, that's an interesting story, that one, because The guy has, the guy who was flying the drone says he has data that says it was high enough for it not to matter. And the guy said, "Oh, it was my daughter was sunbathing in the garden in a bikini. I don't want that drone around." And you know, I get the points. I get both points. But having said that, that's why we don't, as a rule, allow guns in this country. It's just to stop all the shooting, which is largely unnecessary.
Well, before we get onto a topic that likely will inspire political emails, let's call it a day there for the topic. But do let us know what you think about drones and these drone laws. Should we be educating people more rigorously about what is and isn't acceptable when flying a drone? Do we think it's a good thing that companies are getting together to create independent products to, for want of a better term, shoot them the hell out of the sky and have them plummet to the crust of our Earth, the Earth? Let us know your opinion, podcast@natelangson.com. Well, this week I was pottering around the... I'm really sorry, but let me finish. I was pottering around the internet, and upon what did I stumble? A Harry Potter book on the iBook store. Now, this isn't in itself particularly interesting news. Old book comes to new store. But the truth, and in fact, the intriguing part of this story, is that these are new interactive editions created in tandem, you know, in partnership, if you like, with J.K. Rowling and Apple. Now, I thought this was an interesting story because the Harry Potter books, apart from in their audiobook forms, have not been available on Apple's platforms. They have been only available through J.K. Rowling's Pottermore store. But these are interactive editions. They have new illustrations. They've got author notes, all sorts of things. The whole series have been made available. And it just got me thinking, there's a generation of children now who were not old enough to read, or perhaps not even born when the Harry Potter books were at the peak of their popularity, or before the films came out. And I'm wondering, is this what kids are after? Is this what parents are after for their kids? That the existing printed pages were not good enough to capture their children's attention, or indeed their own attention, perhaps. So I wanted to find out a bit more, and I got in touch with a gentleman called Andy Robertson, who is a family tech expert, and I wanted to find out from him what exactly makes these books so special to warrant a press release, and of course, more so, to be on this podcast.
I think there's a demand for them to be in the space, because then they're in that sort of ecosystem of kids browsing books and apps on their tablets, and obviously they want to see Harry Potter there. But my experience, particularly with my kids, is that actually almost the reverse. They would prefer to read a book as a physical product, as a, you know, physical artifact, but then would quite like secondary experiences that would maybe be apps. So my boys are into this Beast Quest series, and there's a really good Beast Quest game. And I was asking them over tea, actually, around, you know, what do they think of this? And all of them said, actually, I'd prefer a physical book, even if it had clever, pretty pictures that did stuff.
Interesting. I found that quite surprising, actually, being surrounded by tech. I don't think I was expecting to hear they were more inclined to opt for something more traditional.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps because they do use the tablets a lot. And we kind of try to put limits on that. So there's the idea of maybe limited screen time. So they sort of think, well, if I'm going to use my screen time for something, I'll use it to play a game or to do an interactive experience. And then I'll use my non-screen time to do something like read a book. And they sort of seem to segment it like that. So I think because they do so much on their tablets, to have something different, they quite enjoy. And we still do sort of bedtime stories, even though some of them are a little bit old for it, they still quite like it. And again, they want a physical book that they can peer over and see the pictures.
Just for context, Andy, how old are your kids at the moment?
I keep changing ages, but I try and get it right. 7, 9 and 11.
Okay, let's say you hadn't asked them for their opinion first, and maybe they were a bit younger.
Yeah.
Would you be inclined to go straight for the printed books, or would you go for a digital version like this as their first experience of something like Harry Potter?
I think it is quite nice as an introduction, but I think that's what it is. It's an introduction to a series of books rather than an introduction to then reading it on a tablet. I think they probably are. It maybe depends what sort of family you are. I mean, my take on this was actually this might be something which would be quite useful for commuters who want to reread the Harry Potter books. And obviously they don't want to carry the big books around with them, so they can then read it more easily on their Apple devices. But then I was realizing that I don't think there's like a bundle to buy them all. They have to buy them all individually. So it would have been nice to see the complete collection bought relatively cheaply.
I agree. The UK prices are £6.99, which seems reasonable as there's extra content, but a bundle would have been nice, yeah. The other side, I suppose, is that there have been audiobook versions of these stories on iTunes for years. So I was a bit disappointed these weren't included in some way, maybe like a read-along.
Yeah, I like the read-along idea, particularly if you've got a child who's learning to read. If they can listen to someone reading something and follow along in the book at the same time, there's obviously then they start to make the connection between the words. I also, a little while ago, there was this trend for the PlayStation called Wonder Book, which was an interactive storybook. And the headline product, really, that was the idea that was going to spark, but it never quite caught light, I don't think, was some J.K. Rowling content around the Harry Potter theme. And this was truly interactive, though. So you put the book in front of the PlayStation.
Yeah, it was called The Book of Spells, I think.
That's right, yes. And then there was a Book of Potions as well. They sort of did two iterations in 2 years. And they were really good, actually. They were, you know, quite unusual experiences. So I think potentially they struggled to find a market because people didn't quite realise what they did. But that is that sort of thing my kids are much more excited about, which takes them to, it was proper augmented reality, and it was that real content, but also the interactions that they were using with the Move controller to actually use a wand in the space. And I've not seen, you know, how interactive these iBooks versions are, but I'd imagine it's more just like pictures on a page moving rather than something that's fully featured as Wonderbook. And I think to catch kids' attention these days, you need to do something quite special. So it's obviously something new and different rather than just saying, hey, you can read your book, but now it's on a tablet.
There are a lot of interactive elements to these re-release books, and there are plenty of books going on sale digitally for the first time that have visually enhanced features in some form, particularly in kids' books, I think. And it makes me wonder whether savvy future authors should be thinking about interactive components to their stories as they're writing them, in the same way we did at Wired when writing content for a magazine that would be printed as well as presented digitally every month as tablet editions.
I see a similar thing happening in the opposite direction with video games, and I think it's potentially a mistake to try and sort of cross-pollinate media too much. I think books are brilliant at being books, and you start to try and make them be something else and they can lose their sort of bookishness. It's a similar sort of thing to, I think, when a video game starts making itself like a movie. You know, video games are great because they're video games and interactive. And I think, for me, books, you know, are great because they're this very sort of traditional thing and you know what it is. And I like interactivity, but I don't want it in my books.
That makes sense. I suppose it's becoming about choice, which is always exciting. Sometimes I just want a story, and sometimes I want to have a hand in unfolding that story. But if I'm feeling too lazy to play a video game, then I'll watch a movie and have a story played out for me, hands-free, if you like.
Yeah, and there's this sort of whole trend of watching games on YouTube, which takes that to sort of the next step, where you literally get someone else to play the game.
Andy Robertson, thanks for joining today. It's been really interesting to get your input as a parent and a tech commentator combined. Tell people about your programs and videos on YouTube.
Yeah, so we look at games and technology for families, and it's kind of a low excitement look compared to lots of other YouTube channels, I think, which are trying to be sort of kids' entertainment. We try and be slightly more considered and offer something which entertains kids but also offers some useful information for parents as well. And you can find us at it's youtube.com/familygamertv.
Time for a bit of feedback. We've got a couple. We're going to start with one before we get into our next story. This comes from Rob. And Rob says, in reference to your rant about Virgin and upload speeds, it's not just podcasters and media folk who need broadband upload speeds. Like many others, I work from home. Now, this was going back to last week's podcast, I think, Ian, or possibly the week before,
yeah,
where we talked about Virgin upping everybody's speed to 200 meg down if you're on their top-end fiber optic package, but not increasing the upload speed at all. Which lags behind quite considerably. So he says, Rob continues, bit of context, I'm an IT consultant working for a large technology company, and when I'm not out with customers, I work from a home office. Rob says, I need to be able to send emails with attachments, do voice calls using Skype, however. However, I can't expense this as a work item. According to HMRC, if I didn't have internet connection before I started the job and my job mandated I needed one, then I can claim that as a business expense. However, if I already had an internet connection, then I'm not allowed to claim that as an expense. And as much as I'd like to have business-grade broadband into my house, my employer isn't going to fund that, and my wife isn't going to be best pleased with additional holes being drilled through the walls. So I've got to use the personal broadband connection. Just thought that was a bit of a spin on your guys' argument around upload speeds becoming more important in the way we do things. 100% agree with the comment about Apple Photos uploading 4K videos, and Google's Photos app is similar in process. And he says the new Google Nexus 6P does 4K video as well. He enjoys the podcast. Thanks, Rob, very much. Yeah, so it's interesting. Basically, he's in a slight difficult situation where it's not just as simple as him getting broadband drilled into his house, because the tax office wouldn't cover that as a business expense for his home office, and his wife doesn't want drills coming through the building, which, fair point. But even if he was alone and working in his underwear eating cheese crisps, which I have done on more than one occasion when working from home, it wouldn't matter as far as tax was concerned. He'd still have to use his existing internet connection. So it does sort of warrant the case that there should be a better option for upload speeds for people who don't or can't have a business connection but do need faster upload. That was quite interesting, Ian.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that everyone should have faster upload. It's just... I just think it's not having fast upload belongs to an era that's long gone. I mean, technically, it's not a problem. It's not as easy as download, I guess, but I think it should happen. And there are some technical reasons it's important to, like keeping pace with a downstream. There is a certain ratio, and of course, with Virgin particularly, if you flood your upstream, it can affect your downstream as well. Mm. It's worth remembering and can cause problems. But you can obviously always do something your end about that.
One more news story wanted to get to. Something that Ian and I are both quite passionate about. Not passionate like Emmanuel, 1970s film that I was terrified to find out that my mother went to see with a boyfriend once when she was a lot younger. Not the conversation you want with your mother when you're 18 years old and she discovers you've got a copy on DVD in your bedroom. Don't actually know why I'm saying any of this on the podcast, actually. This isn't in our lineup. It's completely irrelevant. Let's see if it makes the final cut, shall we? Let's continue into this news. The Microsoft Surface Pro 4 has been announced, and beautiful it looks as well. Much like Emmanuel in the aforementioned.
Now, you're just making it hard to cut it now.
You know what, mate? It's fine. I've dug myself into a hole. And
you're prepared to deal with it.
Well, there's a bar down here, you know, and if the world does end up in nuclear winter, I'll be slightly longer lived than everybody else. So we'll just... continue to exist in this little podcast bunker that we've made.
Amazing.
And you're in here too, buddy.
Thanks.
So the Surface Pro 4 starts at £749, and that's for the most basic model. We're not going to directly compare it to the iPad because it's probably more comparable to something like the very high-end Samsungs and Lenovos of the world. It's sort of a fully-fledged PC in a tablet body with a keyboard optional. And it's got 128 gig of storage, 4 gig of RAM, Intel Core M3 processor. That's one of the fanless designs, and that is on the lower end of the speed spectrum in terms of the 749 model. So, Ian, firstly, I wanted to get your thoughts on the model itself as more of a Microsoft aficionado than I am, and also the pricing, £749. Interesting. What are your views?
Well, the Surface Pro is a decent machine. It's well-liked by everyone that uses it. I think pricing-wise, I mean, it is just a laptop, really. It's just a slightly different form factor, isn't it? It's designed very much for people who sort of want a bit more flexibility. But ultimately, I think most people end up using it with a keyboard dock anyway, which, obviously, I suppose we should come on to because there was another product, wasn't there? The Surface Book, which obviously is a first for Microsoft.
It's Microsoft's first laptop ever.
Yeah, and the thing about that is it's a really interesting product. They were obviously very excited about it. I've never seen a Microsoft press conference like this before. It was pure. It was a really unique sort of thing. It's difficult to explain. When you watch an Apple press conference, they have a real style and a tone, and it's always very consistent, and it's nice. You know, it's done well. And Microsoft has never had that. It, you know, it fluctuated. It was different with Bill Gates. It was a lot different with Ballmer. And now they've settled into this really weird thing where they get some people to come on stage who you wouldn't necessarily associate with tech in if you met them in public. They're just very odd, but they're great because they have a personality. And it was something that I think Microsoft really lacked before. And so these guys came on stage and were obviously very excited about this Surface Book, which is like a Surface, detachable screen, but of course it has this brilliant keyboard dock that makes it into a laptop, but also can contain an NVIDIA chipset to give you discrete graphics if you want. A very clever idea, actually. And a lot of people, me included, are very excited about it. Can't wait to get our hands on it. And that did overshadow the Surface a bit, which is kind of a shame because the Surface has been kind of a big deal for Microsoft. I mean, it may not have sold the most amount of units of any product ever announced, but it's obviously inspired Apple to some extent because they've got the iPad Pro that's, arguably takes a few cues from the Surface. And it's fantastic to see Microsoft being the source of some inspiration for people. But then this, you know, this new Surface Book comes along and suddenly that's all anyone's talking about. But it looks amazing.
I agree. I think they look very, very compelling. The design is fantastic. They look very, very, very good. And the specs are good. They're elegant.
Very expensive, though. Oh, my.
They are going to cost... I think the top-end model for the Surface Book is pushing something like $3,500.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are high-end. These are expensive. But that will always trickle down as it tends to. But what I find interesting is that if you go back to the Microsoft XP era, around 2000, 2001, there were some hybrids like this. There was an HP Compaq that was basically a tablet that ran full Windows XP with a detachable keyboard. And it sort of feels quite full circle that Microsoft has finally come back round to the idea of using Windows on a tablet. But it took them, you know, whatever this is, nearly 15 years to get there. And finally, they've got their dream,
but they're
having to do it themselves this time.
The technology's caught up, hasn't it? I mean, the dream has always been, I think, to have computing be much more portable. And having this tablet form factor is, by its very nature, a bit more portable because you can always detach the screen and just use that. But at the same time, you've got these wafer-thin keyboards that don't have any electronics behind them. And I think the point is it's a reversioning of a laptop, isn't it? It's taking what was beneath the keyboard and putting it behind the screen, and modern miniaturization has made that possible without having this huge, chunky tablet thing. Now you can have a tablet that is really thin and kind of defies belief. You know, you either have a dumb keyboard or you have what Microsoft's done where you put a little bit of extra into the keyboard that makes it even better value kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, we've got no launch date or price for the Surface Book in the UK.
Grown.
As we mentioned beforehand, they are extremely expensive on the US side of things. But on the UK store, you are able to pre-order the Microsoft Surface Pro 4. Now, the Surface Pro 3, I thought, was a fantastic one. I reviewed it for Wired back when I was there. It's really great. It's running Windows 10. The top-end model, I was just very curious. So while we've been talking, I've been looking at this. The top-end model cost £1,800 for the Surface Pro 4.
Yeah, that's expensive. I mean, £1,800 is a loss of money.
But that's got bearing in mind, these are all fanless designs. Actually, no, I completely lied. This one isn't fanless. This one has a Core i7 chip, so that's their desktop chip. So it means this one does have a fan. But that's got half a terabyte of storage, 16 gig of RAM, and that is £1,800. But on the M side, it's only the very entry-level model that has the fanless Core M3 chip. The rest are all in the i-series, which have fans
also,
traditionally.
Did you notice, and you probably did, but when they were announcing the phones, that they mentioned that they had basically built in water cooling to their phones?
I didn't notice
It's quite good. If you go back and watch the presentation, obviously it's not water cooling in the traditional sense, but there is a closed loop system in there. that they use. And I don't know why, but it's interesting because actually, if you think about it, a lot of the problems that people have with phones could possibly be solved by better heat management internally. I've always thought that about Sony phones because they build this, you know, hermetically sealed unit that keeps water out. And then they have countless problems with overheating, and they always have done since the Z1. And I've got to say, well, perhaps that's something to do with the way you design, obviously, because heat dissipation is it's an impossible thing to get absolutely right a lot of the time, especially when you're constrained around design. So I don't know, maybe there's a future in water cooling handheld devices to some degree.
Maybe. I mean, the iPad is obviously has no fan. I don't find that has a problem with heat.
No,
they're
bigger though, aren't they, the iPads? And, you know, same with all tablets, really. The size really helps. When you're packing a lot in on a phone, you know, putting it behind a battery, which naturally gets hot when it discharges, and, you know, having these processors running at gigahertz, you know, it's not unsurprising that things get hot, is it?
No, true. Well, we're going to have to watch this closely. Obviously, this is coming out in November, which is around the time you'll start finding the iPad Pro in stores. Also, a 12-inch fanless tablet with a smart stylus and a high-res screen and all the rest, which we're going to be coming to in a review in a couple of weeks, so don't miss that. But going head-to-head on the big tablets ahead of Christmas, very exciting. Let us know what you're thinking about these new tablets. podcast@natelangston.com. Well, we've just got one quick email to round off the end of the day. A little bit of a different bit of feedback that came in here from Ryan, who discovered us via Jonathan Strickland's Tech Stuff podcast, which is fantastic. So, hello, Ryan. Now, Ryan says, I'm 16 and wondered what careers I should look into. I love to write and I love tech, so when I found out that you guys review new technology, then write about it, I thought it was something of a dream job. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's what you. Anyway, I would love to know more about this field and what is required to enter it. Actually, any details or info you can give would be appreciated. Well, I thought this was an interesting way to end the show because extremely broadly, I suppose, yes, we do review new technology and write about it as one aspect of Ian and I's jobs and have been for the last 10 years, I suppose. we kind of got into it through similar ways. We're just very into it and wrote a lot about it and then got hired to do it at a time that people were hiring people to write about it online.
Yeah, I mean, people actually, jobs haven't been too bad recently. That I've seen quite a lot of stuff. You just have to be prepared to come in and work for very little money, I think, is the key,
yes.
Which is depressing, and something I'm always going to fight against because people should be paid properly. But
yes.
I guess if you're 20, I mean, obviously he's 16, but if you've finished college or whatever, 21, then you are prepared to work for a little bit less, aren't you? And if that gets you a break. But, you know, you did it the right way, Nate. You just settled down and set up a blog, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I taught myself to code and then bunked off school largely to teach myself the other bits that I needed. And then,
don't do that.
But I think three interesting tips. If you are in the case of Ryan, who is 16, loves technology and is curious about writing about it, number one, that will be your advantage, start now. No time like the present to write and to observe what makes other people's writing good.
A lot of the skill that we gained was thanks to people like Nick at CNET, you know, who was our sub. It, getting shouted at on a daily basis is a good way of learning. It's difficult because obviously you have to get started somewhere. But working for free is just, that's people taking advantage of you. And you have a talent and a skill. You know, obviously you have to hone it a bit first. But there will always be people who'll be prepared to read your stuff. It doesn't have to necessarily be, you know, tech experts. Find some, if you're at school or college, you know, just go and find a, you know, an English teacher and they will happily help, I'm sure. They'll be probably blown away by the very idea that someone is voluntarily doing something outside the curriculum.
The other thing, the final point I was going to make is that the wording that you used in your email, Ryan, said that you thought that writing is something of a dream job. While in the past, only writing would have indeed been a possible dream job, these days you will need to expect to be able to write and visually present and possibly even code your opinions in some form. So having a bunch of additional skills, whether that is with how the fundamentals of web design works or coding or photography or editing some kind of media, whether that is in itself websites or apps or just... you know, videos and photos and what have you.
Well, it's definitely useful to go into a job interview or, you know, to pitch a thing with a, you know, say, well, look, not only can I write this review for you, or, you know, look at this product, get a hands-on with it, whatever, I could also give you these great pictures and then show some pictures. Because honestly, these days, there's never been any money online for separate photography. You know, it's a pipe dream, isn't it?
Well, back in the day, I mean, I'm going back quite a number of years, you know, 20-odd years maybe. There was a time where you could earn more money as a photographer for a newspaper than a writer.
Oh, you probably still can, but that's a newspaper, and let's be honest, there are not that many newspaper jobs, are there? You know, if photography was your thing, you could go and work for a, you know, a news agency and probably get a decent salary out of it. Unfortunately, and again, this is probably just as bad. I mean, I shouldn't be encouraging it because it goes back to the writing thing, but writers have now had to become photographers as well, haven't they? So ultimately, we're doing a disservice to professional photographers, I guess. But
yes, yeah. And as the brother of someone who is a professional photographer, I should probably say
and a very good photographer at that. Breathtaking photos that guy takes.
Yeah, and but it has to be paired with knowledge about the subject, and that's the key thing.
Yeah.
Know your subject better than other people, and if you can specialize in something that is new and developing, then that's always going to be better, because there's always going to be someone that needs to know something better than they do. And if you can be the right person with the right skills at the right time, then you've got a chance. And I think that there's going to be lots of opportunities, because people's interest in technology ain't going nowhere, my friend. Mm. Well, Ryan asked, can I be the ambassador for the podcast for America? You can. Specifically for the United States of America, because I want to leave South America and Canada open to other ambassadors, because Ryan, your enthusiasm is great, but let's be honest, it's a bloody big place. So yes, we've got a few ambassadors for the podcast in different countries or cities. So please do let us know if you would like to be your local ambassador. It basically involves telling people and colleagues and friends about the show and helping them install it onto their phone or podcatcher or what
and
have
where
you.
Necessary, breaking out the Ferrero Rocher.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you to Ryan, and thank you earlier to Rob for their emails. Podcast@langston.com is where you can send them, or just go to the podcast page on the website and send it through the form, which most people do seem to do, I've noticed. We're also at Text Message Pod on Twitter if you want to follow us there. I'm also at Nate Langston, and Ian is
at Ian Morris 78.
Yes, indeed. And on that note, we will see you in 1 week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.